Accession number 14284, Reel 5.
Mr. Carling, Reel 5. Any memories of the men coming back from Dunkirk?
Oh, yes, very, very vivid, I might tell you. I think I'd mentioned to you before that we were lined up to form the 13th Troop Carrying Company. Most of us had volunteered in response to Malcolm Campbell's appeal, which had been broadcast early in 1940. They needed people who could drive, you know. You might like to be reminded that just before the war, well, there weren't so many people who were able to drive as there are nowadays. The company was sitting at Adelstrop. I think there's a wonderful poem about Adelstrop Station. I wish I could remember the name of the fellow who wrote it.
Where's Adelstrop?
In Gloucestershire.
Leicestershire?
Gloucestershire.
Gloucestershire.
Yes, beside Chipping Norton and places like that. However, we were sitting there waiting to go to France, of course. As a troop carrying company. Of course, all the troops that we were supposed to carry went into the bag, you know. They all had to pull out in an awful hurry. And we had the job of sorting out the survivors of the Dunkirk calamity who came back without any kit, in a, what shall we say, demoralized state, a very a difficult crowd of people to deal with, you can imagine. Most of them didn't want to go back, particularly the fellows who'd stood in the drink and waited for the little boats and been bombed and strafed by the Stukas and things like that, you know. We had to kit them out again, of course. They all came to make up our strength. It made a big difference to us because those of us who had volunteered in response to Campbell's appeal had been joined previously, before the Dunkirk effort, by quite a lot of Belisha boys, these young conscripts, 18, 20. Most of the chaps who volunteered were like myself, 20, 30s. It wasn't a very good mixture. None of us had really been in the army before properly. The chaps in the conscript group had been more or less nursed into the army. You know, they were taken in at 18. They were set up in proper billets. Everything was organized for them in peacetime soldiering way. And when they were suddenly thrown into our kind of billets, that is to say, old country houses with no beds and just blankets, no sheets, nothing like that, no visits from mother. They were very difficult indeed. And I had, by then I had a stripe, acting unpaid Lance Corporal stripe. And had the very, very much of the job of coping with difficult characters. And we got some fresh ones, of course. The chaps who came back from France, a lot of them had been regular soldiers. A lot of them looked at my stripe and they just couldn't believe that somebody had been in the army for 2-3 months, had a stripe. They'd done 6 and 6 and and still had more or less no evidence of their experience at all. Mark you, a lot of them were promoted quite rapidly. We had some NCOs who just couldn't carry the weight of their rank at all. The really difficult task, as I say, was kitting these chaps out again, which meant that there was a considerable relaxation of what shall I say, quartermaster's issues. Our sergeant major could go to the stores and say, oh, we've got another 50 fellas coming, we've got another 100 fellas coming, or whatever. And he would draw 100 shirts and 100 long pants and 100 pairs of boots. And no question, these chaps obviously had no kit, they had to be kitted out. Unfortunately, our sergeant major had been promoted from corporal more or less in the course of 3 or 4 weeks. And he got himself caught flogging flannel shirts in the village. That's one of the sad things you hear about the army, you know. But, not everybody's honest in the army. that poor chap, I often laughed about it. You can imagine that living in a country house was very difficult.
But did any of these Dunkirk people actually desert?
Hundreds of them went absent without leave.
But was this just temporarily to see that?
Well, I dare say with most of them, it was a question of, well, I've got to get home and see how the wife is. This particularly for the London boys, where the Blitz had really started hitting us. The word got around, the London boys must get home, you know. Come what may, they could have their leave, which got up our noses. The Geordie lads didn't seem to matter, you know. You can stay where you are for the time being. It didn't worry me an awful lot, but there was a certain amount of resentment against the London chaps who were given priorities. A lot of them were very crafty with it, you know. They had some good tales to tell. My wife is having a baby and all this kind of stuff. I had the job of collecting quite a few deserters, you might call, or people who were absent without leave. With one stripe, you were liable to be sent off to go and pick up somebody from the police station near his home and bring him back to the unit. One or two quite adventurous efforts.
But were they compassionate cases, or were they people who were just swinging the lead?
They would start out as compassionate cases because obviously the compassionate cases got the priority. A lot of them, when they got home, they decided that they were going to make an excuse of some kind, that they weren't going to come back this week. If they'd only had, say, 7 days leave, they were just going to take 14 days leave. I think that was overlooked. In many cases, people were simply charged with being absent without leave for 7 days and probably got 28 days jankers, or, you know, punishment of some kind. But the people who stayed away too long obviously had to be reported to the local police. And if you were reported to the local police, they went and collected you, or the military police went and collected you, and you were taken to the nearest guard room, and your unit was informed that you were there, and somebody was sent to escort you back to your unit. I think the best joke I can tell you about it concerned a little chap who went back to my home area, Tyneside, and didn't return, and got picked up eventually by the police, and I was sent to collect him from Fenham Barracks. And when I got there, he was such a mild little chap, you know, I thought, well, you know, he's all right. And I said, come on then, lad, we'll just down the road to train. Once we're on the train, we'll be all right. And he said, we'll go past my house. He said it in Geordie. We're going past my house on the way to the train, to the station. Can I go and tell the wife, you know, that I'm going back down to Gloucestershire? And I said, oh, all right, yes, of course. I was supposed to have him handcuffed to the escort. But we walked up the stairs. It was one of the sort of back places where he lived. And the approach was to the upper floor was on an outside staircase. And I said to him, all right, go in. And let him go in to see his wife in what was, I suppose, the one room which they had. We waited for a few minutes, and then I sort of knocked on the door and opened it, looked in, no sign of him. I said to the woman, where's he gone? He's gone, he's gone. She's crying, you know, and putting on a tremendous show. He's gone, he's gone. And I looked round and I could see that there was no way that he could have got out the room except by the window, which we had been adjacent to. You know, the landing of the staircase that we'd come up was right alongside the only window in the room. And I was just beginning to get a bit puzzled about this when his leg came through the ceiling. He had climbed up through this trapdoor into the loft, and poor lad, in the dark, he'd trodden in between the joists, and there's his boot hanging out above the bed. Well, I leapt up under the bed, and the woman let out a tremendous scream. I grabbed his foot and hung on and said, come on out of it, come on out of it. And of course he struggled. And of course the rest of the ceiling came down, and he came down there in the melee as the woman and the bairn and him and me all rolling about on this horrible double bed that more or less took up most of the room, you might say.